Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute. It's time to begin.
With the paperback edition of Cinderella Ate My Daughter. I love this title. Peggy was born in Minnesota, went to Ohio to Oberlin College. Ah! The Oberlin alumni thing. And now lives in the San Francisco Bay Area with her husband, documentary filmmaker Stephen Okasaki, who has been nominated for 4 Academy Awards for his work, and their daughter, Daisy. This is certainly a timely title, as we all can see on, if you watch some of the reality TV things, etc. So let's welcome Peggy and get at it.
Thank you all for coming out and supporting your local independent bookstore. Yay, Tattered Cover. I really appreciate it. And Girls Leadership Institute, which is an absolutely phenomenal organization and part of the solution to the things that I'm talking about tonight. And, of course, the Oberlin alumni. Thank you all for coming. I appreciate it. So I want to talk to you a little bit about how I came to write this book. And I think what I'll do is talk a little, read a little, talk a little, read a little, talk a little, and then we can all talk. Does that sound like a plan? I wrote this. I'd been writing about teenage girls for a long time, and I had been looking at the issues that that they faced. And then, you know, the short reason I wrote this was I became a mom, and I had a daughter. And, you know, I don't know how many of you have girls, but when you hold that little girl in your arms for the first time, you just feel like you don't want her to feel like she has any limits. You want her to feel like there's nothing that she can't do because she's a girl. You don't want her to feel there's anything she has to do because she's a girl. And my husband and I were going along, and we were raising our daughter, Daisy, that way. And then she went to preschool. And oh, how the mighty fall. And within about 2 weeks, she had come home and she had memorized all the names and gown colors of the Disney princesses. And I didn't even know what a Disney princess was. And meanwhile, we were walking around town, and I live in Berkeley, California, so, you know, you can imagine what was going on where women actually shaved their legs. But I lived in Berkeley. We were walking around town, and we would go to the supermarket, and the guy behind the checkout counter would say, "Hi, princess," and we'd go to the drugstore, and the lady behind the checkout counter would say, "Would you like a free balloon? I know what color you want," and give her a pink one without asking. And we would go to the breakfast joint owned by Green Day, which has the pierced and tattooed waitresses, and they would give her princess pancakes. And finally, we went to the pediatric dentist, you know, the one that charges double because they've got a Pac-Man in the lobby. They have that here. And the dentist said to my daughter, "Do you want to sit in my princess chair and I'll sparkle your teeth?" And I just went, "Do you have a princess drill too?" I mean, seriously, I remembered availing myself of my mom's cast-off tiara now and again. You know, royal play is as old as King Arthur's court. But I did not remember this mandate that 24/7, 365 days a year, for 3 solid years of my life, I was not only supposed to pretend sometimes to be a princess, but that was all I was supposed to do, and I was supposed to do it publicly as well as privately. So thinking about this, I didn't know. You know, it was confusing for me as a mom. I didn't know if this was like, you know, post-feminist celebration or something to be concerned about because, you know, it wasn't really supposed to be funny. On one hand, I was confused. On one hand, you know, girls were doing so well. They were flooding the playing fields. They were going to college in greater numbers than boys. And yet the pressure to define themselves through appearance, with that appearance very narrowly constructed, had not abated one whit, and that pressure was skewing younger and younger. So I looked at research that said things like there was a survey of 2,000 elementary school-aged children. And it found that girls, and they repeated it over the course of the decade, and found that girls' concern over their appearance and their weight went up between 2000 and now. And it now tops their concern about their schoolwork. And that's elementary school age girls. And thinking about things like that, I decided to, and then on the other end of the spectrum, there was a report that came out recently from Princeton University where they found that over the last decade, the percentage of female students who were willing to take on leadership positions, either elected or appointed, had dropped. And the reason, one of the reasons that came out was that the young women felt that they had to do everything, they had to do everything well, and they had to look hot while doing it. So thinking about those sort of two ends of the spectrum and the dominance of the importance of how girls looked and what we know about the vulnerabilities that girls encounter when they focus on their looks. There was a report from the American Psychological Association that found that when girls focus excessively on their looks and when they're sexualized, when they learn to judge their body as they think others are judging it rather than how it feels to them, they become vulnerable to the things that we worry about, to eating disorders, negative body image, low self-esteem, poor sexual choices. So thinking about all that, I decided to go on this journey. And I went through a journey that took me from Disneyland to American Girl Place to a Toddlers and Tiaras beauty pageant contest, so you don't have to go, to a Miley Cyrus concert, so you don't have to, to delving into Twilight and hanging out on Facebook. And I wanted to look at this continuum of what girls were seeing and hearing and playing with and being exposed to from toddler through the tween years, and how that was affecting their sense of self, the development of their sexuality, their body image, the future relation, their future relationships, and their sense of their academic and professional potential. So, like I said, I started with the princesses because I wanted to see if the very thing that we thought was protecting girls from premature sexualization was actually priming them for it. And it turned out that there was a reason why I had never heard of the Disney princesses, and that was because they didn't used to exist when we were kids. Now, I know what you're thinking. There were movies, right? There was Cinderella, there was Snow White, there were these movies. But the deal was they would be in the theaters for 2 weeks. There'd be some merchandise that was associated with them. And then what Disney would say is they'd go back in the vault. And then you would not see, and all the merchandise would go away, everything would go away, and you wouldn't see anything associated with that character for 7 years until a new crop of kids grew up. So what changed was a new head of consumer marketing came in, consumer licensing, and he went down to Phoenix to familiarize himself with the brand at an ice show, and he saw all these little girls dressed as princesses, but they were using their imaginations. They weren't using official Disney-licensed products. This was a huge profit opportunity lost. So he scuttled back to Burbank, and he came up with this idea of the Disney princesses, where he took these characters for the first time in the history of the company out of their movies and marketed them together under one royal rubric. And this was a really controversial move, and this is my favorite piece of Disney trivia I'm going to tell you now. So Roy Disney, who's Walt's nephew, was against this because he said, you know, you can't put Cinderella and Snow White on the same, you know, you can't, they can't be like having tea together because that would be mixing mythologies, and I don't know, the world implodes. I'm not sure what happens, but it's bad. So to appease that faction, I don't suppose we have any Disney princess items handy, but if there's any in the store, you can look. You do? Get one. You will find that on any product where there's multiple princesses, they're always, this is a t-shirt, they always are looking in, each is looking in a slightly different direction. That's because they're not supposed to know that the other ones are there. Now that you know that, it's going to drive you nuts to see it everywhere. It also has this kind of weird, subtle messaging to me, though, of, you know, princesses don't have girlfriends. You know, God forbid Sleeping Beauty should give Belle a little support. They don't have mothers and they don't have girlfriends. So there's also this way that it kind of isolates them in their own world. But anyway, they put those products out there. And the first year, 2000, they did $300 million in business, which, you know, not bad lunch money, right? 10 years later, $4 billion a year. And there are over 26,000 Disney Princess products, which when you think that they can't slap them on cars, cigarettes, liquor, antidepressants, you know, even thinking of 26,000 products, right, that's kind of a challenge. So they have to do things like Disney Princess grapes, actual grapes, like in the supermarket grapes. And as that happened, it became less about some of the essential positive characteristics that some of those characters have and a lot more about the bling. So it became a lot less Cinderella and a lot more Wicked Stepsister. And you never see Cinderella in her rags anymore. And it also began to cannibalize all other forms of play. So, because when Disney makes $4 billion on something, you can bet everybody's going to get into the act. And that's why everything from the toothbrush to the t-shirt to Dora the Explorer has all gone princess. So, in addition to everything going princess, the other thing that has happened simultaneously is the rise of the color pink. And what I want to read to you now is a little bit from the book about pink, from a chapter called Pinked, in which I go to the annual toy fair in New York. And did she get a Disney Princess product? Did you get a Disney Princess product? Yeah. You can do a little lovely Carol Merrill and show people the, just do a little display so they can see.
Just a few.
But anyone you look at, they're going to be, see, there they are not looking at each other. It's just something that starts to bug you after a while. It's just a piece of trivia, but it's now for the rest of your life, you're going to walk around your local supermarket and your local Target and everything going, oh my God, she's right. Anyway, I'm going to read this. So, the annual toy fair at New York's Javits Center is the industry's largest trade show, with 100,000 products spread over 350,000 feet of exhibition space, and I swear at least 75,000 items were pink. I lost count of the myriad pink wands, crowns, and infinite permutations of pink poodles and purses. The Disney princesses reigned over a new pink royal interactive kitchen with accompanying pink royal appliances and pink royal pots and pans set, though I would have thought that one of the perks of monarchy would be that someone else did the cooking. There were pink dinnerware sets emblazoned with the word princess, pink fun fur stoles and boas, pink princess beds, pink diaries embossed with princess, ballerina, or butterflies, pink jewelry boxes, pink vanity mirrors, pink brushes and toy pink blow dryers, pink telephones, pink bunny ears, pink gowns, pink height charts, a pink princess on the P board game, one square instructed, wave like a princess, pretty as you can be, my little pink book board game, a cool game for girls in which they secretly choose a dream date from their little pink book of guys and then try to be the first to guess who everyone else is dating, and a pink toy washing machine. All of those, however, were perhaps to be expected. Less explicable were the pink sky kits, spy kits, pink rollerboard suitcases, pink cameras, a giant pink plush squid, which from behind looked exactly like a giant penis, a pink plush boa constrictor, a pink plush beanstalk, pink rocking horses, pink cowgirl hats, pink gardening gloves, pink electric pianos, pink punching balls, pink gumball machines with pink gumballs, pink kites, pink pool toys, pink golf clubs, sleds, tricycles, bicycles, scooters, and motorcycles, and even a pink tractor. Oh, and one pink neon bar sign flashing live nudes. It's not that pink is intrinsically bad, so don't feel bad if you're wearing it, but it's such a tiny slice of the rainbow. And although it may celebrate girlhood in one way, it also repeatedly and firmly fuses girls' identity to appearance. Then it presents that connection, even among two-year-olds, not only as innocent, but as evidence of innocence. Looking around, I despaired at the singular lack of imagination about girls' lives and interests, at the rows and rows of make-your-own jewelry, lip gloss, nail polish, fashion show, craft kits, at the drumbeat of the consumer feminine. Is all this pink really necessary? I asked a bored-looking sales rep, hawking something called Cast and Paint Princess Party. Only if you want to make money, he said, chuckling. Then he shrugged. I guess girls are just born loving pink. Are they? Judging by today's girls, that would seem to be true. The color draws them like heat-seeking missiles. Yet adult women I've asked do not remember being so obsessed with pink as children, nor do they recall being so pervasively sold to them. I remember thinking my fuchsia and white-striped danskin shirt and its matching stirrup pants was totally bitchin'. But I also loved the same outfit in purple, navy, green, and red. Yes, I had them all. There must have been a sale at Sears. My toys spanned the color spectrum, as did my hair ribbons, school notebooks, and lunch boxes. The original Easy Bake oven was turquoise, and the Susie Homemaker line was teal. I can't imagine you'd see that today. What happened? Why has girlhood become so monochromatic? Girls' attraction to pink may seem unavoidable, but children weren't color-coded at all in the era before Maytag. I'm sorry, I just missed a spot there. Anyway, girls' attraction to pink, let's try that again, might seem, I need reading glasses, unavoidable, encoded in their DNA. But children weren't color-coded at all in the era before Maytag. All babies were white as a practical matter, since the only way of getting clothes clean was to boil them. What's more, both boys and girls wore what were thought of as gender-neutral dresses. When nursery colors were introduced, pink was actually considered the more masculine hue, a pastel version of red, which was associated with strength. Blue, with its intimations of the Virgin Mary, constancy, and faithfulness, symbolized femininity. Actually, if you look in the old Disney movies, you'll find that, for instance, Wendy in Peter Pan is wearing blue, and Michael, her little brother, is in a pink PJ. Sleeping Beauty is wearing, and Cinderella too, but Sleeping Beauty is wearing a blue gown. Prince Charming is wearing a lovely pink flowing cape. Why or when that switched is not clear, but as late as the 1930s, a poll of its customers conducted by the New York City department store, Lord & Taylor, found that a solid quarter of adults still held to that original split. I doubt anyone would get it wrong today. It was not until the mid-1980s, when amplifying age and sex differences became a dominant children's marketing strategy, that pink fully came into its own, when it began to seem innately attractive to girls, part of what defines them as female, at least for the few critical years. Now, I hadn't really realized how much marketing dictated what we think of as developmental or natural to kids. And when I was doing this research, I found that, for instance, the toddler. I assumed that somebody with a PhD had made that one up, but it turns out it was a marketing construct that was developed in the 1930s to differentiate little boy babies from little girl babies, because it was thought that parents would be looser with their purse strings if they thought their son was going to be treated like a little man. And it was only after it became a common shopper's parlance that it became something that was a fully, you know, a full developmental phase. And if that seems difficult to believe, think about the word tween, right? Tween, which I used to, you know, total marketing construct, usually applied to girls, started in the 1980s. I've seen it used for girls as young as 7, when Bonnie Bell says girls become adept at wielding a lip gloss wand, to girls as old as 14, which is an age range that I would submit to you does not and should not have a lot in common. So, splitting kids into ever smaller groups like that is although it may seem sort of counterintuitive, is the best way to boost sales. So, I mean, doing the same thing to penguins would do it too. So splitting boys from girls and creating these kind of pink and blue ghettos doubles your sales. And one executive called it to me the pink factor, so that it was a leapfrog executive who said that if you have a boy first, you're going to buy all this stuff. And then if your second child's a girl, you're going to want to celebrate that little princess. So you're going to buy everything again in pink. If your first child's a girl, you're going to get everything in pink. And then, oops, second baby's a boy, got to get it all over again in a different color. Either way, they double their sales. Oops, I just lost my place here in that little rant. That pinkification could, I suppose, be read as a good faith attempt at progress. The advent of pink tinker toys, designed especially for girls who can build a flower garden, a butterfly, a microphone, and more, might encourage preschool girls to use mechanical and spatial skills that might otherwise lie fallow. Or it might reinforce the idea that the real toy is for boys, while that one measly pink Lego kit in the whole darn store, this was before Lego Friends, which we can talk about, is girls' consolation prize. It could even remind girls to shun anything that isn't pink and pretty as not for them, a mindset that could eventually prove limiting. And what about the girl who chooses something else? I recall taking Daisy to the park one day with a friend who had a pink Hello Kitty scooter and matching helmet. Daisy's scooter was silver. Her helmet sported a green, fire-breathing dragon. "How come your helmet's not pink?" the friend said. "It's not a girl's one." Daisy furrowed her brow, considering, then said, "It's for girls or boys." Her friend looked skeptical. Even though I was relieved by Daisy's answer, I found the question itself disturbing. Would other girls view her with suspicion, even exclude her, if she did not display the proper colors? I hoped her friend would get the message and broaden her repertoire. I hoped that Daisy would resist the pressure to narrow hers. So, as girls move from 2 to 3 to 5, something else gets fused with that dyad of pink and pretty, and that's shopping. So you start seeing in the toy store aisles a kind of a different shade of pink. You start seeing things like the Hasbro made new board games, pink version of their classic board games, like the Monopoly game, which is about, as they say, all the things girls love, where they've traded out the houses for boutiques and the hotels for shopping malls. Yahtzee, they've replaced the dice with flip-flops, hearts, flowers, dresses, cell phones. And Scrabble, pink Scrabble on the cover has the racks with a 7-letter word. Guess what it is? Close. No, that's 8. F-A-S-H-I-O-N. 7-letter word. And this is also where we're seeing a sort of aging down. I call it kind of, well, we saw this first in my family. Daisy got a make-your-own messenger bag kit for her 6th birthday, and it had all these, like, iron-on transfers of hearts and flowers and stars and, you know, all whatnot. And then it had iron-on transfers of, that said, spoiled and brat. And to her credit, you know, she said, "Mom, why do they want me to put spoiled on my purse?" And I said, "I don't know, honey. Let's go get a cookie and throw that away." Because, like, I'm in this too, right? I don't pretend like I know something you don't know. I'm a parent, you know? They have that tiger mother. I'm like the dog on 4 roller skates mother. So I thought about it, though, and what I came up with was this idea of girls' power with a Z. Because anytime you see that Z, you kind of got trouble. And whereas girl power celebrated ability over body, which we were talking a lot about in the 90s, girls' power casts the pursuit of physical perfection not only as a source, but kind of the source of girls' empowerment. And it sells them self-absorption as self-confidence, and narcissism and materialism as a source of power. And that's why you put spoiled on your person. Another way to think of it is the Kardashianization of girlhood. So when you walk through the Toys R Us store now, you start seeing, you know, a lot of sassy, which is sexy with training wheels. You start seeing a lot of the spa beauty parlor parties for the 3-year-olds, the craft kits that are all about nail polish and lip balm, the science kits that are all about nail polish and lip balm, and on and on. And so there's this kind of bombardment and these endless pink poodles and purses. I don't know what that's about. So I talk about that and the kind of how that as that sort of diva culture has trickled down to little girls and the impact that it's having on them. I talk a lot about I go to the Toddlers and Tiaras pageant and I talk about some of the developmental issues, the reasons boys and girls need to be friends, a whole variety of things. But one of the things that I talk about in the book that's really near and dear to my heart is the way that the increasing sexualization of girlhood undermines girls' healthy sexual development. And that's a key topic to me. And it's something that I think that we as adults who care about girls, whether we're parents or grandparents or just advocates or teachers or whatever we are in girls' lives, can really do something about in helping them disentangle the threads of what sexualization is and what sexuality is. And one of the things I think about as a Rorschach for that is the difference between learning that your role is to be desirable and learning to connect more deeply to your own desires and needs and wants and understand those. And I think that that's a pretty good indicator of when you're looking at something of what's going on here. And for me, one of the places that bait and switch between sexualization, where sexualization is conflated with sexuality or sexuality is conflated with sexualization, is most clear is in where Disney wants your kids to go after the animated princesses, which is to the flesh and blood princesses like Selena and Miley and Demi and, you know, whoever the girl of the moment is. But Miley was the girl of the moment when I was writing and I think remains the most emblematic. And because I'm a cruel, cruel woman, I'm going to read you the Miley Cyrus concert section. I have to find it. It's in a chapter called Wholesome to Whoresome. That's a word I made up. But I think that it really illustrates this conundrum. And the only two things you have to know before I read this are, if you recall, when Miley was 15, she appeared in these Vanity Fair photos where she was kind of naked and had this, like she just got out of bed with a lover. Her hair was kind of tousled and her lipstick was mussed and sheet kind of falling down. She was looking back. Although the other picture with her where she's kind of draped on her dad was way creepier, but whatever. So you need to remember those. They caused a huge, huge outcry among parents. Well, I guess that's it. You already know that I went to a beauty pageant. Okay. Oh, that the Disney guy, his name is, I forgot his name all of a sudden. Well, we'll get to it. You'll remember. Mooney. Thank you. Andy Mooney. I just had a blank moment. Andy Mooney. So this is the section from Miley's concert. Miley Cyrus grinned down from giant banners flanking the entrance to the Oracle Arena in Oakland, California. Miley Cyrus only at Walmart, they announced. Beneath them, fans lined up five deep, hoping to catch a glimpse of their idol live as she strode from her tour bus in the parking lot to her backstage dressing room. It was the fall of 2009, and this was the second stop on Miley's 45-city Wonderworld tour. The crowd, mostly in the 6 to 9-year-old range, with a smattering of 10 to 12-year-olds and a few stray teens, waved homemade cardboard signs with Miley's or Hannah's picture pasted on them, surrounded by hand-drawn flowers, puff-painted hearts, or feathers. "Miley, you rock the house," one read. "Hannah Montana songs are the best," claimed another. A year ago, my own daughter had come here for a Disney on Ice show, invited by a friend who was celebrating her birthday. The party guests had dressed as Cinderella, Belle, Ariel, though Daisy, perhaps due to months of maternal propaganda, chose Pocahontas, the only child to do so in a crowd of thousands. The mob of girls here tonight, including the ones just a year or two older than the Ice Show crowd, were also dressed up as Disney princesses, though the nature of the costumes had changed. They wore miniskirts bare-legged with high-heeled boots topped off by pink and black buffalo-checked fedoras, zebra-print shirts with sparkling bodices that would have highlighted their cleavages had they had any. Several little girls swung by in white furry boots and low-rise black pleather jeggings, a combo of jeans and leggings. A stretch Hummer pulled out to disgorge a group of what I'm guessing were second graders in black minis with chains slung low across the hips and pink fingerless gloves. I doubt that the 6-year-old with the crimped hair and fuchsia mini would describe what she was wearing as sexy. To her, it was just fun, attention-getting. Disney's Andy Mooney had told me that Princess, and so presumably by extension Hannah and company, was aspirational, and I was not so sure that I wanted my daughter aspiring to this. Pink and Pretty had been marketed to parents of preschoolers as evidence of their innocence, a harmless, even healthy way to identify as a girl. Now for their older sisters, the pitch was changing, looking hot, or at least hot-esque, at concerts or on Halloween, after school, in your dance routines, was the way to express femininity. Two slightly older girls walked by, gum cracking, hips swaying, eyelids darkened with thick liner. They wore identical skin-tight micro-minis, black camisoles and boots, again with bare legs. One had thrown a pink neon feather boa around her neck, the other a chartreuse one. They seemed about 12, so I figured they were old enough for the look. Then I recalled the beauty pageant I had attended, how quickly I had become accustomed to 5-year-olds with spray tans, teased hair, and lipstick. And I reconsidered. When, exactly, had a 12-year-old stripperella ceased to shock? When Miley finally appeared, the crowd rushed forward, screaming at a pitch attainable only by young girls and Wagnerian sopranos. Next to me, a little girl in a Hello Kitty t-shirt and pink cowboy boots jumped up and down, nearly out of control. "I can't see, I can't see," she hollered. Miley, dressed in her pre-show outfit of black cargo pants and a tank top and oversized shades, crinkled her nose endearingly and waved at the crowd. Her smile seemed genuine as she stopped to pose for photos and sign a few hurried autographs. Even after she was well out of sight, the fans continued to yell just for the joy of it. A 10-year-old with a secret star shirt and multicolored barrettes stared in disbelief at the picture of Miley she'd snapped on her cell phone. "I'm sending this to everyone on my contact list right now," she announced. It was admittedly sort of heartening to see girls swoon for a female star rather than for the latest Backstreet, Hanson, Jonas pretty boy. Inside, real-time text messages went by the audience, sent by the audience, scrolled by on screen surrounding the stage. "We love you, Miley. I love you. My 5-year-old's first concert. She loves you." When the lights finally dimmed, the crowd screamed again, frantically waving light sticks. Smoke machine fog rolled across the stage, clearing to reveal what appeared to be a giant chrysalis surrounded by whirling dancers. A figure stepped out, head covered by a drab shawl, Suddenly, flames exploded. Lasers bounced across the stage. The figure threw off the shawl, and it was Miley, her brown hair flowing, her cargo pants and tank top replaced by black leather hot pants and a low-cut leather vest. She burst into a song titled Breakout. I don't know how this goes, so I'm not going to sing it. It feels so good to let go, whoa, whoa, she sang. This was a very different girl than the one who some 2 years earlier, on the eve of her 15th birthday, had confided to Oprah Winfrey that, I look way young and that's the way it's more comfortable to me. The one who had said that she chooses clothing that will get the thumbs up from girls and their parents. The one who only a year before Barbara Walters had introduced as any parent's antidote to the common crop of teen train wrecks. Back then, yeah, Miley had earnestly told Walters why she was different from Brittany, Jamie Lynn, that's Brittany's sister, Lindsay and the Olsen twins. Some people don't have a family to fall back on, and faith. She, it was implied, was a girl whom parents could trust, not to treat clean values as a stepping stone to something else. She was sincere. The Vanity Fair photos hit the web less than 3 months later. Even those who were inclined to cut Miley some slack, to chalk that incident up to a momentary lapse in judgment, began to wonder in the summer of 2008 when she debuted her new single, Party in the USA, on the Kids' Choice Awards, whose audience is made up largely of preteen girls. She strutted out of a trailer in booty shorts and a sparkly tank slid up the sides to expose her bra. As she sang, she stepped off stage onto an ice cream cart with a pole, the kind that would typically be used as an umbrella stand. Then, hanging on with one hand, she dropped into a squat, her knees splayed, her back arched. The move was, to say the least, at odds with the image of the family-friendly pop star she portrayed on TV. Once again, controversy broke out. What kind of sticky sweet treat was this flavor of the moment selling? Miley claimed the crotch was harmless, not to mention personally improved by her father. Bloggers called the umbrella stand a stripper pole with training wheels and accused Billy Ray of pimping his 16-year-old child rather than doing his paternal duty by protecting her. Around that time, Miley was also photographed in Elle magazine, lying on a table wearing a short skirt and thigh-high black boots. In both cases, she once again apologized to her fans, though she was beginning to come off as the child star version of Richard Nixon. More and more, the mistakes were seen as part of the plan. It was Miley's turn to cast off the role model mantle, along with the worshipful audience who had believed it was real. By the time I saw Miley in concert, she had agreed, after some tense negotiation, to stay at the Disney Channel for a final season of Hannah Montana. But the Mouse House was already moving her out. There's always a new girl in the wings, someone who promises not to disappoint by shucking her principles along with her clothes. For the moment, both Selena Gomez and Demi Lovato were being promoted as the anti-Mileys, though at this writing, Selena seemed to be breaking bigger. It goes without saying that in interviews she comes off as down-to-earth and adorable. That's her job. A Wall Street Journal profile gushed that her every teen dressing room was decorated with a bright floral rug, a shag blanket thrown across a sofa, and a few scattered bookshelves. A quick Google search of her news items generated around the time of her album's release portrays her as a UNICEF ambassador to Ghana, a dog lover, and someone who gives back to her community. Although she's actually a year older than Miley, she looks younger, and she assured the Journal reporter that she's in no rush to be 25. Sound familiar? Historical memory for pop culture tends to be short, especially where children's idols are concerned. The parents of today's six-year-olds have only a hazy recall of Hilary Duff's or Britney Spears or even Lindsay Lohan's stints as good girl icons. So it's easy to convince them that this girl is unlike those others, that this time it honestly will be different. I want to believe it myself. I like Gomez. But I wonder. Her virginity has already been made a selling point. Like Miley before her, she wears a true love waits ring, meaning that she has vowed to remain pure until marriage, presumably to a Justin Bieber clone on a white horse. I wrote that before they started dating, I would like you to know. I called it. And she doesn't wear the true love waits ring anymore. I suspect that you cannot commodify a girl's virginity without eventually commodifying what comes after. Regardless, how realistic, how desirable is that Disney version of girls' sexuality, either for Gomez or for her fans? Let me be clear here. I object strenuously to the sexualization of girls, but not necessarily to girls having sex. I expect and want my daughter to have a healthy, joyous, erotic life before marriage, long before marriage. I do, however, want her to understand why she's doing it. Not for someone else's enjoyment, not to keep a boyfriend from leaving, not because everyone else is. I want her to do it for herself. I want her to explore and understand her body's responses, her own pleasure, her own desire. I want her to be able to express her needs in a relationship, to say no when she needs to value reciprocity, and to experience true intimacy. The virgin whore cycle of the pop princesses, like so much of the girly girl culture, pushes in the opposite direction, encouraging girls to view self-objectification as a feminine rite of passage. The debate over whether Miley's or Britney's or Vanessa's or someday, mark my words, Selena's photo spreads are too seductive or too suggestive for her age is beside the point. Of course they are. They have to be. What other choice do those girls have? What other choice are they given? Ultimately, it was not Miley's Vanity Fair shoot or the stripper stunt or the hooker heels that crossed the line. It was the fetishizing of her wholesomeness, the inevitable trajectory from accidentally to accidentally on purpose to simply on purpose sexy. Why isn't it until that final leap, when a girl actively acknowledges and participates in what's happening, that parents of young fans cry foul? So we go on from there, and, you know, as I say, I talk about a lot of other things, and particularly the ways that femininity and sexuality and identity can become a performance for girls, and the ways too that social media can accelerate that. But now you're all sitting there, and you are all looking so grim and bummed out, and I feel terrible. So let's talk a little about the upside, okay? Should we do that? So because I think that it's really important. You know, the reason I wrote this book was to start a conversation and to get people thinking about the culture and understanding the culture, because that's really the first step. And there's a couple of different ways to approach this. One is, the big collective way. And there have been some fabulous campaigns on this. The Lego Friends, which I mentioned earlier, which is a girls' Lego set that has them building, beauty shops and cafes and such. 52,000 people signed a petition when that came out in December saying, we want girls to play with Legos, but maybe not so much like this. And Lego is now meeting with the heads of girls' advocacy organizations to discuss change. And, I just feel like when we put our foot down as a collective unit, another example was last summer when JCPenney put out a T-shirt that said, I'm too pretty to do homework, so I have my brother do it for me. I know. Think how many layers of people had to approve that, right? It was gone in 12 hours. They pulled it because parents and advocates of girls just went, are you kidding me? No. And they responded. Abercrombie took their padded bikini bra top for 7-year-olds off the market, too, within 12 hours after it kind of surfaced. So there are incidences where people are coming together and saying, no, we're going to do something more positive than that. And I think about it a little bit. I noticed that Michael Pollan's coming to speak here in a couple of days at the Paramount Theater. And I think about it a little bit like the food movement, I mean, if I had stood up here 10 years ago or more and talked to you guys about free-range chickens and, organic vegetables or something, trans fats, you would have thought I was crazy. But now, you know what I'm talking about, right? I mean, it's not, maybe you change and maybe you don't, but, there's been a lot of change in the way people eat, a lot of consciousness, a lot of health concerns, a lot of sustainability, and it all came from, and it's not everywhere, it's not everybody, but it's significant. And it really came from conversations started by a couple of books, by Omnivore's Dilemma, by Michael, and by Fast Food Nation. And those books changed a big part of the culture. And when McDonald's, in the wake of that, added healthier items to its menu. And I feel like, gosh, if we can change McDonald's, we can change Mattel, So there's that big stuff. And then there's the individual level stuff. What do you do as a parent? And, saying no is part of it. Certainly. No is a good word. It's not enough because I think you can never really convince your daughter you're giving her broader choices by saying no to her all the time. So I've learned this the hard way. I was in the Los Angeles airport with my daughter, and there was a rack of Thai girls dolls, which are like Bratz dolls but plush, like Bratz dolls meets Groovy Girls. It exuded some kind of gamma ray, and she was like, "Mom, can I have one of those?" I just went, something snapped. Something just snapped in me. I just went, no, you are never, ever, not ever, ever, ever getting one of those. And she's like, why, mommy? And I was like, it's inappropriate. That's why I just, why is it inappropriate? And I didn't want to explain. And I just thought, I am so sick of the teachable moment, I'm so sick of the teachable moment. I don't want to have it. But I couldn't always say no. So I just thought, you know, I need to find things that I can say yes to. And the way that you have to approach this in part is to fight fun with fun. And it's the neutral stuff is all great, but we get into this mode where we think the opposite of femininity is masculinity, and that if your kid's not wearing a pink princess dress, she's sleeping with a football. And I really think there's this like third way. And so on my website, which is just peggyornstein.com or cinderella8mydaughter.com, I have a button that says Fight Fun with Fun that you can go to, and it has, I'm developing this list as a community, just a free community resource of books and movies and clothing lines and, you know, things for parents and all kinds of stuff. That fights fun with fun. And just as a little example, that same year when Daisy was four, we were reading child-friendly Greek myths. And for Halloween, she went trick-or-treating as Athena, the goddess of war and wisdom. So she still got to wear the kind of, you know, toga thing and the dress, and she still got to wear the cool thing on her head. But it was a really different idea of femininity than Disney's Cinderella. It was much more powerful, much more internal, much more self-determining. And so it's not just about trying to find, you know, neutral, although that's part of it. It's also about trying to offer girls an alternative idea of what femininity means that they can grab onto. So that's really important to me. And a third piece is giving power back to girls. And that's where something like Girls Leadership Institute comes in, which I've had a lot of, I've worked with a lot. I think they're just terrific in their programs that work with bullying and media literacy with girls now from second grade through high school. Is that right?
Kindergarten
through high school. And I knew that. And there's other places online, which, again, you can find on my website list, like Spark Summit and Powered by Girl, where they have things that you can download for those of you who are teachers or advocates or just, you know, want to hang out with girls and do stuff with them, activities that you can do with girls that give the power back to them, that turn them, from princess to heroine. Like PBG has, they put up ads and they have girls write something on the ad about what, you know, what the ad says right back on the ad. And they write something funny, they write something crazy, they write something serious, but anyway, it works. So I want to just end by telling one last story, because you're creeping up on me. I can see you creeping up on me. And it's that I love the fairy tales. I love the fairy tales. And I particularly love Cinderella, not the Disney one, but Cinderella, the oldest version, is in China in, I think, 850 AD. And there's something like 700 variants of Cinderella across all cultures. And something that universal, you know, it's got to have something to it. So I like the Grimm's version, which is Aschenputtel, but I'm going to say Cinderella because my voice hurts. And so it's really super bloody. You know, the stepsisters cut off their heels and their toes to get in. The blood is spurting everywhere. There's these doves that the Cinderella nicely asks them to go into the church with her to be their bridesmaids, and they peck out the stepsister's eyes. You know, think of those wedding photos. It's just disgusting. But it's got this great concept that the beauty of the fairy tales is when you read them at different stages of your lives, you find different things in them. And in this Cinderella, what I find is this. It's about these three girls, and their father goes on a business trip, and he asks them what they want him to bring back. And the two stepsisters, Kim and Chloe, they ask for bling. And Cinderella asks for a branch that grazes her father's cheek. And she brings it back, and she plants it in her dead mother's grave. And she waters it with her tears. And the branch grows into a beautiful tree. And there's no fairy godmother in this Cinderella. There's no pumpkin, none of that stuff. It's the tree that she talks to, the tree that she cries to, the tree that gives her the wherewithal to go to the balls, which last for three nights. And so there's this way that the story is about how a dead mother's love transcends the grave and guides her daughter from girlhood to womanhood. And when I think about it that way, I think, you know, we've got to bring back the tree, right? All of us, you know, whether we're men or women, whether we're parents or grandparents or advocates or babysitters or whatever we are, we have to be those strong roots and those sheltering branches that don't, you know, like the other fairy tale says, don't lock them in a tower, but help them learn the vocabulary and the ways so that they can navigate through the thicket, through the forest, and find their own real and true and authentic happily ever afters. So with that, I will stop. Thank you. Do we have time for a couple questions? Yeah. Thank you very much. Ellen. Hi. Good to see you.
What do you make of the pink ribbon campaign?
I can't answer that in 30 seconds or less, honey. I write about it all the time, though. If you go and look at my website under articles or search breast cancer, because I'm a breast cancer survivor myself. 15 years ago, I had breast cancer. So I've paid very close attention to that, and I've written about Komen's foibles a number of times and the ways that the Pink Ribbon campaign has infantilizing aspects to it. Creates a generation of sheroes who are survivors of early stage cancer while completely marginalizing, you know, the opposite of the survivors, the dyers. The dyers don't get a lot of love, you know. The metastatic women don't get a lot of love from Komen. And then, you know, the dubious partnerships. I could do a book on that. I haven't, but I've written a series of opinion pieces and articles on it that please look up and read, please, before you give another penny of your money to a breast cancer organization. But do give money, just to the right ones. Yeah.
What else has Daisy been for Halloween?
Oh, gosh. She was a sorceress one year. Gosh, is this a trick question? I can't remember. Oh, Kurt. I didn't even see you back there. Tricky. Karate, martial arts girl, I think she called herself one year.
Not Mulan?
No, but she did. Mulan, you know, got to give Disney Mulan, except that now we loved Mulan. We loved Mulan 2, which has this song that is called Why Can't I Be Like Other Girls, which is sung by the princesses are like the pathetic characters in Mulan 2. And they're talking about how hard the life of a princess is and how much is demanded of them because they're about to go off and marry strange men to consolidate the kingdom that they don't want to marry. And they are singing about how they wish they can scrape their knees and climb trees and have cake. And when we were listening to that when Daisy was 3 or 4, she'd go, Mommy, why do they want to scrape their knees? You know, and I said, well, you know, it was, and she listened to that song about 790,000 times trying to figure it out. And I think it was really a turning point for her in thinking about the princess culture. So Disney actually offers a solution, though now they have a new Mulan out, she's wearing her hanfu, the kimono thing, which she despised, and it now has a big tulle, pink, poofy, sparkled, it's like the anti-Mulan Mulan. And I can't remember what else she went as, Kurt. I'm sorry, but those are the ones I remember. Yeah.
I teach your work in a sociology class.
Oh, thank you.
Of her argument about Cinderella culture. And one of the answers that I challenged them on in discussion today was, I loved princesses and I turned out okay. And the relationship between these preschool obsessions and these tween marketing strategies that we can unpack, I'm having these conversations with university students who feel fairly empowered in their interpersonal relationships, and to try to sell them that there's a toxicity to this early childhood culture that will carry with girls is a harder sell to the students I'm talking to. And so I wanted to present to you so you can give me better tools for having this conversation with them.
Well, I think it would be, naive and ridiculous to say that every girl who picked up a wand was going to get an eating disorder. I mean, that's absurd. So to say I played with princesses and I'm okay is just sort of almost, I don't know, insulting. But it's just a ridiculous argument on the face of it. You can't even... Yeah. It's like, you know... But I think talking to them about... when I talk to college students and I start talking more about the performance culture and the pressure to, you know, how you have to look on Facebook, how girls have to present themselves on Facebook, what gets likes, what doesn't get likes, the sort of idea of pleasing versus pleasure, desirability versus desire, they stop cold. Cold. They may say they feel empowered in their interpersonal relationships. Maybe they do. But that stops them dead. And I can see them all suddenly go, ugh. And that's where they want to go. I mean, the other day I had a whole conversation with high school young women about, what's that dancing style called? Grinding? Is that what they call it? Yeah. And how they felt about it. You know, how they felt about it. They felt compelled to do it and they didn't like it. But they didn't know how to say no about it. So I think, you know, there was this performance of sexiness. I think if you start talking to them about the performance of sexiness, that they can connect to it a little bit differently and think about, you know, when you're little, you're saying so proudly, mirror, mirror on the wall, I'm the fairest of them all. And then suddenly you're on YouTube going, am I ugly? You know, that's the new YouTube thing. Vote, am I ugly, for girls. And that's a kind of magic mirror too. So the magic mirror of the culture, they're not, when they get to the other end, saying, am I pretty? They're saying, am I fat? Am I ugly? Am I sexy? They're not saying, how do I feel? They're not saying, how do I feel to myself?
One
yeah,
more.
One more.
Can you comment a bit on the American Girl, because my 6-year-old granddaughter just smoothly transitioned mm-hmm. from princess to American Girl.
American Girl question. I have such mixed feelings about American Girl. The books are great. Love the books. Oh, I'm sorry. The question was, thank you, I forgot. The question was about American Girl, whether American Girl, how I felt about American Girl. And they have some really great values, but man, they charge a bundle for those values, don't they? You know, princess culture is cheap. To get good values, you got to pay a fortune. And if you go to American Girl Place, I talk about it in the book. I went to American Girl Place, but I didn't take my daughter because I didn't want her to know about it. So I took a friend's daughter who told me going in that, with my friend, who told me going in that she wasn't into American Girl anymore because she was 10 and she was too old for it. We walked in there $500 later. And she didn't even get that much, right? I mean, that was like tea and, you know, getting a makeover for her doll and like a couple other things. So, you know, and I thought that when they came out with the Jewish American Girl doll, Rachel or Rebecca, whatever her name is, I thought, oh, she's really cool. And then I looked at the stuff and I thought, $60 for a Sabbath set? I can get my kids some candlesticks for that. I don't need to get one that's this big, you know? So I feel mixed. Like, it's not that it's really like they're inherently bad, but they both inculcate positive values and consumerism simultaneously. So they're complicated, I guess. I wouldn't say shun American Girl, but it's complicated. I think American Girl is complicated. And we have luckily avoided it because my daughter thinks their teeth are weird. So.
We'll save your place.
Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.